call to order for the work session. We'll do roll call. So the Dachshund Master, Ms. Blom.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, now I lost one, so.
You lost one? You're down to two?
Two, yeah.
You gonna get another one now?
No, just the two.
Just the two?
Yeah, so what he's referring to is I had 2.5 hot dogs, now I have 1.5. So, yeah, I'm here. Thank you.
The commissioner from Thailand? Or is it Pakistan?
Actually, I live at 1055 Northeast 7th Drive in Newport. I'm just on holiday.
Okay. Mr. Hanselman?
I too am residing here for the evening.
Mr. Berman?
Yes, I am also here.
Gary?
And I am here.
And Mr. Updike?
Here.
All present and accounted for. So we have unfinished business. First up is number 2A.
Yeah, so for the work session, I've got the two carryover items, and then want to confirm that we picked up the changes that you discussed your last meeting correctly. So the first piece here we have is walking kind of through the city's rules that apply to the establishment of an RV park. The city has a number of parks, all but one. South Beach State Park and East Side are the only ones that I'm aware of that would be compliant. That are compliant with current rules. Most of the rest of them that we have are mobile home parks that were built under different rules back in the day. East Side actually was built under older rules, but then was renovated to bring it into compliance, and then it was sold.
East Side?
East Side is the park next to the high school. Sorry. So we've got a handful of RV parks in the city that are private, and then you've got the large, state park in South Beach. So East Side was purchased a number of years ago, and the owner, it was the Websters, who picked it up along with other property from the party that they, I believe they picked up the Undersea Garden property as part of that same transaction. And so what they did was they renovated East Side to bring it up to current code and then sold it. And then South Beach State Park has gone through one or two different expansions since I've been with the city, and each time they've come through and met the code. But outside of that, what you'll see around are some smaller private ones that are non-compliant. They're non-conforming, built under whatever standards were in effect back in the day. I can think of at least three. No, Harbor Village would be another one down there on Bay Boulevard.
Okay. One on the highway up near us, is that?
Yeah, there's two of them up there. One on the east side, one on the west side that I can think of.
The one on the west side, it looks like. I've never been down in there, but it's...
Right, there's another one on the east side too, which is non-compliant to some degree. So, I mean, that's kind of what we have at this point. Mm-hmm. So what we're going through, I just want to give you some context. So the current code that you're going to be looking at has been applied sparingly over the years because we just haven't had a lot of RV park development. We have somebody who has expressed interest. Well, we've got a couple of folks. One down in South Beach who's expressed interest but not moved forward, and another one up in Agate Beach next to, right next to the Stars, Samaritan Stars facility, the undeveloped piece next to it on Gladys. That individual has expressed an interest in doing an RV park. But when I've conveyed to them what they have to do to actually do it, he kind of backed off because there's expense involved. So what I wanted to do is kind of walk through what the rules are. What I did was I've got the city's recreational vehicle code, and then with that I contrasted the administrative rules. The state administrative rules we have to apply, much like we do our building codes. So they're kind of the baseline. And you'll see as I go through, there are some areas where the city requires more. And I guess the question I have for you is that appropriate or not? There's probably some room to make some changes here to make it a little bit less expensive to establish an RV park. And that's the lens that I'd encourage you to take a look at it, because this is, again, this is our housing production strategy. This was one of the items is, hey, we need to take a look at this and see if there's something that should be done or not. So I'm just going to kind of pan through here. The first at 060 is basically calls out where they're permitted. They're permitted conditionally in the R4 or the R or the I2. And if publicly owned in the P1 and P2 zones, they're not allowed in the, and haven't been allowed for many, many years in Nye Beach. And then they're allowed outright in the C1, C2 outside of Nye Beach, C3 and I1.
Derek, what's the distinction between a manufactured home village and an RV park?
They are different. A manufactured home park or manufactured dwelling park has a different set of standards. They're considered to be, for a manufactured dwelling park, you're looking at a park that's designed for year-round occupancy. I mean, these are people, you know, the units are expected to be a place of habitation. RV park standards are not set up that way. They were based on the premise that in an RV park, your occupancy will be transient. That's why when you look at this, for RV parks, they're not required to provide water service under the administrative rules to each individual pad space, because the presumption is RVs have some water tanks in them, but they are required to have gray water disposal, you know, and a restroom. So again, you're not required to take power to each pad site for an RV park. That's not going to be the case in a manufactured dwelling park, because you're dealing with homes there under the traditional sense.
But like the one on 6th, that's sort of a hybrid. They have some RV spots back in the corner.
And I think I'm thinking of Surfside too, which is the one on 3rd, also has RV and park models in there. The state over the years, not within the last probably 10 years, passed a law that says, well, a couple things. One, we have to allow RVs in manufactured dwelling parks, and we cannot regulate the tenancy or how long they can stay in a manufactured dwelling park. So, and I believe that, you know, when you think about it, the premise there is that manufactured dwelling parks, as opposed to RV parks, are designed for year-round occupancy, have the, you know, the utilities and everything in there to support year-round occupancy. And that's in, and there was recognition, I guess, too, that some folks choose to live in an RV, or that's what they have, and so that's one way to accommodate RVs in a way that allows them to in a year-round type occupancy.
But no tenancy requirements.
Yeah, we can't. We're barred by state law.
That's right.
In RV parks too.
I believe so. I'd have to go dig back into that one, Bob. But the standards are certainly designed. I believe we are prohibited in an RV park too. I think we have to stay away from tenancy, but I can check that.
I thought it had to do with wheels, like manufactured parks. Homes would be year-round because you don't have wheels. Something like that. But Pacific Shores, they live in theirs, but that's still in the city, isn't it?
Yeah, the one up on the north side, yeah.
Yeah, because
that RV, that was designed as an RV resort, but they can
live there.
They're living there.
Yeah.
Do VRBO rules apply to recreation vehicles?
Good question. Yes, they would presumably apply if they're outside of a park. If they're in a park, they wouldn't, because they're in a park. So if and we had this come up, so don't laugh. This has actually happened. If somebody goes to South Beach State Park,
right,
and lease and get and rents or leases or whatever you want to pays for a space in South Beach State Park or for a number of days and sets up an RV there that's fully equipped and then goes on Airbnb and rents it out, we would not consider that short-term rental. That would be because it's in a campground where that's expressly permitted.
What's
got an idea?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just thinking, what's the investment to get into this?
It's an odd, I mean, so, but if it was on a private lot, we would consider it, you know, a short-term rental if they were using it, you know, for transient purposes, renting it.
What's the little place, I'm going to say 45th, just out past me, there's a lot in there with six RVs can fit in that.
One on the corner there?
It's
kind of back.
You got to go in the cul-de-sac to get to it kind of thing. Actually, it's a direct drive in, but there's like five or six spaces. They've been there probably since the late 90s, something like that.
Well, you have here and there along the coast, you have a few spots where they developed like basically mini RV parks because they provide ocean views. Very, you know, and so, you know, and it varies. I don't know the circumstances of the one you're talking about, whether or not those are individually owned pads or they're leased or.
Yeah, I think you're getting closer. They lease them or.
You know, or it's some sort of joint ownership arrangement, much like you would have with a timeshare.
Yeah. Yeah,
I don't know.
They fall under this kind of regulation? Simply
the establishment of the pad sites would, yes, because it's RV. I mean,
I think they blacktop the entire land use that they had, which caused the front to slip, you know, which affected numerous neighbors. So,
anyway, cool. I think we're reasonably permissive in terms of locations. I didn't see a real need to tackle what zones they're permitted in, but I mean, I can certainly bring language to that effect if you.
Isn't the port property a W zone?
Yeah, the port prop. No, it's commercial. Well, there's two of them. Excuse me. There's the big one is W2. That's the one that's fully developed. And then there's the other one over by the hotel, which is a commercial zone. We could clarify that. Well, it's permissible in the W-2 through the W-2 language through a conditional use. It says conditionally in the W-2, you can do anything that's allowed in a C-2. Remember? That's what we have on the bayfront as well. So that's how they would get in to a W-2. We wouldn't need to change the code. It's in there. It forces it into a conditional use through the W-2 side of things.
Okay.
That's a good thought, though. We might want to clarify what they have to obtain from the state. This is old legacy language that goes back to a time frame where, frankly, the state handled a lot of the permitting. So I remember running into this with Eastside. You know, they're like, well, what permit are we supposed to obtain from the state? We should be a little bit clearer in terms of what we're asking for, and I could bring some language to that effect.
Does that have to do with the state regulating mobile homes or RVs?
I think it's just has more to do with the evolution of the codes. Of those codes and the capacity of local governments to actually implement this stuff as opposed to the state, especially the capacity of Newport in the past.
One comment is that nowadays the the Building Codes Division is responsible for transferring titles to traditional manufactured homes.
Mm-hmm. Didn't see any issues with C, developer providing a map of the park. That's to our building official. That's pretty straightforward. Then we get into the standards. You know, the city requires 600 square feet be provided for each RV. 22 units per gross acre max. The administrative rule is a little bit less clear, frankly. Talks about each camping space must be large enough to accommodate the designated class of RV. You could adjust that 600 square foot requirement. If you were going to a minimum, 400 square feet would be a one place to go, because that's the maximum size of a park model. That's fully set out. They can't exceed 400 square feet on the RV. That's the maximum that you're allowed to have to stay in the RV class. So,
does that include the crank out? I looked at this.
It's in setup mode, which would be the full setup.
Okay.
Of whatever that unit is, they're all a little bit different.
Well, yes, but obviously they require more space when they get cranked out. So. Okay.
Yeah, but 400 should still cover.
Would still cover that.
Yeah, because 40 foot is, that's about where RVs top out. There's some 45 footers.
That's 10, 10 by 40.
Yeah.
And they can't be, most of them merged right at 8, maybe a tad bit under while they're going down the road, and the slide outs typically are from one side or the other, or no more than 1 to 2 foot. So you'd still meet that.
Yeah, I didn't.
By 40 foot, even with the slide outs out.
Yeah, well. As long as the 400 feet covers that.
So if you want to add some flexibility, this is one area where we certainly could go from a 600 square foot minimum to a 400 square foot minimum.
I think we should do that. The whole intent here is to try and get more for these things available.
Right, and they can, if they need larger spaces, that doesn't stop them from doing that. So, okay, go with 400.
Aren't some of those fifth wheels, though? They look to me like they're more than 40 feet long, maybe not.
No. No fifth wheels. That's about their maximum length, because you might see one, because you're restricted in length of those vehicles with your the size of the trailer, plus you have to include the truck, because that's actually part of the vehicle.
Right,
it's not.
Right.
And I think your maximum length is like 60, is about 65 feet, or maybe 60. I'm not exactly sure. But by the time you put a 40, 45 foot fifth wheel plus your truck, you're right at about that maximum length.
Okay. The next standard on this is roadways. We're more or less the same as what the state requires. We should probably clean the language up to line up better with the administrative rule. Where we deviate is is the surfacing side of it. We require pavement of the roadway, whereas the administrative rule would allow for compacted gravel. So I guess a question I'd have for you is, do you think we should look at allowing something like compacted gravel or hold?
I think absolutely. It's cheaper, and environmentally, it's pervasive surface, as in pervasive. No, what's the
pervious
word? The opposite of impervious.
Permeable.
Pervious. Okay. Yeah. So,
well, we say in here other approved who determines what the approved surface is?
We can be explicit, and I think that's what we're talking about. Up to this point, we've really just gone with pavement. So if you're fine with gravel, I mean, we could tie the language pretty close to the administrative rule, which is compacted gravel, and it has a minimum design load that goes along with it.
Well, I saw load limits elsewhere in here some.
Which is important, frankly. You do need it to be compacted so that it can handle the weight of an emergency vehicle. Otherwise, our fire trucks have a difficult time providing service.
Not to mention you want to own a towing service next door.
Okay.
If our existing rule isn't broken, why not leave the mandate at a paved roadway?
Again, it's cost. Pavement costs quite a bit more. I wouldn't say our existing rules are broken, but they do have some pieces, and this is one of them, that do drive up cost.
And don't these dusty roads create, they have to be maintained. There's dust, cleanup. I'm just thinking of the aesthetics also.
Yeah, there's a maintenance.
I'm not hung up on this. It's just whatever the will of the commission is. I can see some utility in tying the city's rules to go along with and parrot the OARs. I can see the utility in that, so that a developer has one clear set of rules to follow rather than city's rules and then the state's rules. So there's some utility in that discussion.
Why not 1,000 Trails down on 123rd? They have a water truck that they keep. So during the summer months, because they're all compacted gravel.
Yeah.
So when it gets a little dusty, they have a water truck that they run through there just for dust control, keep everything down. Seems to work pretty good.
At what point does the...
All right, I jotted down dust control. I can bring some language for you to take a look at on that.
What point does the fire chief get involved? I mean, because we're about to talk about road width, and there's a diagram, but it went to the building department, not to the fire department.
Well, the fire department's involved in the review. I mean, they're looking principally at access and their ability to navigate through the park. So it's going to be clearances and widths. As I said in here, our standards are pretty similar to those of the states in this regard, which would have been synced up with the fire code. So a 20-foot clear area, which is what's mandated, plus whatever we're doing in terms of parking, is sufficient area for them to get emergency vehicles through. Okay. The other area that we could take a look at, I think we're reasonable on the surfacing requirements for the actual RV pad itself. We allow crushed gravel in that or pavement. I mean, short of that, you could just say you not have a requirement for surfacing. But usually you want something there that's relatively level so that you can set up your RV. I don't know that crushed gravel in this respect is all that tough.
Most RV parks that we go to are all crushed gravel pads, and they work out just fine.
Water. We require it be provided to each space. That's more than it's required, per se. But this is where it gets a little trickier in my mind. It same with washers and dryers and things like that. If we're talking about folks that are living there, that's kind of an important requirement. If somebody's living and they don't have water to the location and they have to go somewhere else to get it, that's the trickier piece in my mind.
I think that would be at least minimum requirement is to have a water to each space.
To each space, which is what we require right now.
Power's
another one. That's
power is optional. I get that.
I'll let you guys debate that one because that then means generators.
Yeah.
And they can get loud.
They do. They do. And people are going to use them if they don't have another source of electricity. Because we're lazy.
Well, I know that when I RV, it's kind of at least my minimum standard is at least water and power.
Yeah.
At least 30 amp, even though my RV is 50 amp, but it works fine on the 30 amp in water. Now, gray water or for black water, you have options. You have mobile tanks that you can fill and take to disposal sites, or you can just unhook your RV and drive it to the site to dump your tanks. But
yeah, our
water and power definitely.
Yeah, I was curious about the gray water comments because anything that ties into the city sewer system, we don't have a gray water system.
Well, an RV gray water dump is required if water services extended to park spaces.
Because of an RV.
Yeah, well, if you're providing water service, now you have to have that. That's required. Yes. By administrative rule, it's required.
And I assume that gray water, black water disposal has to hook into the city's sewer system if it's in the city of Newport, rather than somebody putting in a septic system.
They may be able to do, I can't, sewer, connecting to the sewage system would be an option, and potentially a holding tank that would be pumped out would be another option.
Yeah.
I think either can work. Depends on how they have it designed.
But I think we want to try to avoid septic fields.
Correct.
So they just flat out aren't allowed anyway, are they?
No, you can only do a drain field if you're not within 250 feet of a gravity main, which, you know, we have a few properties like that. Yeah. Most properties have access to city sewer.
Well, I agree there should be electricity. Generators are extremely annoying.
So stick with water
outside of the park. So now you're talking about neighbors.
Stick with water to each site, which then, you know, you have your gray water stuff that goes along. That's the administrative rule. We have to do that. If you have water service to each site, then you have gray water. It's got to be addressed.
But it doesn't have to be at the site.
No, you could have it. The way the administrative rules, gray water, waste disposal, RV parks, which supply water, which would be water to each site, must provide sewage disposal system or gray water disposal sump for each 6 spaces that meets DEQ requirements. I mean, that's what it is. So that could be strategically located.
I think you need to have electricity as well as water to each site. Otherwise, you're going to have
That was the next item, which was we currently require electricity to each site.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would agree. I mean, because I think we do need to think about RV parks now year-round occupancy, not in the transient context. And when you do that, I think this becomes mandatory, really.
Do they have solar on their RV, some of them? No?
Certainly.
Some of them do, yeah.
I think my friend's does.
Trash receptacles, that's required by administrative rule. I don't know that we need to really do much there because it's pretty detailed.
My watch.
Off-street parking, we're actually pretty good there. One space per RV space plus one for every 10.
Back to the trash receptacles.
Yeah.
Solid waste containers.
Yeah. That's the administrative rule.
We went through this with somebody else where, you know, we were arguing, we discussed having Thompson's make sure.
Oh, you want to add some language in here since we're touching this code?
Yeah.
Access to dumpsters.
Yeah, the access to the dumpsters.
Okay.
I'd also like to see if they could include that the tight-fitting lids, covers, and closable tops, I would like them to be affixed. Because otherwise, with our wind, tops and bottoms often part.
Well, Thompson's, if you call Thompson's, well, they have a little thing.
They do. But I'm just saying, that would fit the bill.
But it doesn't work because the other night, Last Friday night, I had them out there and then I had to go out.
Oh, at 5
in the morning. No, all the trash cans were down the street.
Oh my God, yeah, they're all gone anyway, yeah.
And they were heavy, so I don't know.
Had the bungee cord where I used to live because of animals.
The next standard on this, I got the Thompson coordination.
Okay.
The next standard in here has to do with the provision of restroom facilities. It's required under our current code. It's also required under administrative rule. Slightly different provisions in here. I can bring in a merged one so that it covers it all, but it seems fairly reasonable.
They don't have to be flush. Do they have to be flush? I didn't read all that.
No, they could. There was language someplace that said they could be vault toilets.
They could be vault toilets.
I read that somewhere. Since,
yeah, but I think we, again, run into our existing rules, which say if you're within 250 feet of a gravity sewer, you have to connect to the gravity sewer.
Now, do most people in recreational parks use the facilities in their recreational vehicle? Or do they?
Probably half and half.
Because a lot of them are set up to where you do not have, you'll have water and power, but you won't have sewer. So in those cases, a lot of the people use the facilities at the park in order to keep from filling their tanks.
True.
So they don't have to move to
go
dump them.
Right, and the reason that question came about is, quite honestly, I live with a woman, and we camp a lot throughout our lives, and one of the complaints has always been from women is that there's never enough lavatories. You go to the theater, not enough. You go to the park, there's not enough. Where's the line? Right. Where's the ladies' bathroom? Get at the end of the line over there. And So I would only ask that these numbers that the state provides or the city provides, pass that through in front of a lot of women so that they can decide if that's enough. I mean, I'm sorry.
It'll never be enough.
It may not, but I'm really curious about this kind of numbers.
Oh, showers camping too.
Yeah.
Yeah, used to go camping a lot.
Yeah, so I mean.
My dad had 5 daughters.
Oh my God, poor guy.
What a poor guy.
Oh my. Oh man.
Nobody take over the hay business. I agree. Facilities.
Next one has to do with utility billing for clothes washing, and we require it for each 10 RV spaces. Again, if you're looking at people who are staying there year-round, that's pretty important if you start to have any kind of density of RVs, because if they don't have it there, then they got to travel into town to do it. I mean, not that many RVs have that set up. I mean, there are some, but where you can do your own clothes washing. What do you think?
Is that a big problem that you, unless you?
It's a cost. Yeah. I mean, all these things are cost.
Well, that if the RV is your main vehicle, then you got to take your RV to town to do the loaning.
Most of the parks do have facilities, at least, 4 or 5 machines, the ones that I go to, and they're all quarter, they're all quarter machines, so I don't think there's a huge cost to the RV park. I don't know if they have a subcontractor that brings the machines in and maintains them and collects the money and they're just providing space, or if the park owns them, but it's, but... Usually every park that I've gone into has at least three or four washers and 3 or 4 dryers.
You don't think it's necessary?
No, I don't. Because the transient people really don't care. I don't think I've ever used a laundry. Well, that's not true. On a 1-month trip, I've used the laundry. But other than that, it's underwear that you do in the sink and you're done.
Right, but a lot of
the permanent, if you're going to have people living there.
Exactly.
It's a big deal.
It's not a big deal because we do have laundromats in town, and anybody is running an RV and living there, they probably have a separate vehicle where they can throw their stuff in and go get it done, just like
people in an apartment that doesn't have.
Yeah, I take your point, but I view it too that, you know, if you're living in an RV park year round, it's in many cases a lot of the folks that are doing that have very limited means, and to suggest that they have to pile into a car and burn what limited money they have for fuel to go to some place to wash their clothes when a washer and dryer could be in the same location. And as Gary says, if you're an RV park owner, you can set that up as a coin op and offset your costs. So that's not the same as like paving the roads. And you know what I mean?
Well, it's still an extra expense, a development expense.
It is.
I thought that's what's the purpose of this discussion, to see if we could lower those development barriers.
I hear you.
And that's one of them. It's not a big one. It's just a room. But still. I would think it's not necessary, but that's just my opinion, based on my 40 years of RVing.
Other thoughts?
I'd say leave the language in, requiring it. Again, because we're not talking about transient use, so it makes it more livable. It's a reasonable standard.
Yeah. Okay. I'd like to do a little bit of work on this with Joseph. This gets at building spaces and the temperatures that they're to be maintained at, and the construction materials. It gets a little tricky there.
Wait, which one are we on?
I'm looking at 10.
Number 10.
So they have to maintain a room temperature of at least 62 degrees Fahrenheit, have floors of waterproof material, adequate floor drains. Some of that stuff gets triggered under the building code. So I'm wondering if we could nuance that a little bit and just defer to the building code on some of that.
And that's just for the restrooms?
Not with the land use. It's for the restroom and the washer and dryer, I believe, gets hooked in that too. But just rely on the build, because these are subject to building code requirements. Just go that route, not try to get into regulating temperature inside a building. It's kind of an odd standard.
Yeah, that's weird.
You go to the state parks, they don't regulate.
Cold in the morning.
Yeah, regulate temperature in any of their facilities.
Yeah, that's where we used to go.
You'll come home with your thermometer.
Yeah.
We never had an RV.
Pretty much tell it's just freaking cold.
We had a tent for the camper.
All right, next one up was screening. This is one where I think we certainly have some play here. I know Eastside was not happy with this standard. They don't have to put a perimeter fence up around the entire park. That was their way of addressing it, which was, you can do the fence, not less, the 6 foot high side obscuring fence, but why, I guess, should we care about whether or not why should we require screening of an RV park from other residential uses? That'd be my question.
I don't think we should.
Yeah, I'm saying because
that can be a big cost, especially if it's a larger park.
If it's a well-maintained park, I mean, it's not like you're trying to hide a bunch of 50-year-old RVs that are all run down with.
That's exactly what the purpose is.
There's probably a park or two that could use it around here, but for the most part, I think any reasonably maintained park, I think that's a requirement that.
We can enforce nuisance codes, which if somebody is maintaining a site, and they have a bunch of trash built up, and we do have nuisance codes for dealing with that.
It seems when you keep referring back to the east side, and that's probably the least attractive RV park in the city, and a fence, I think, is a fairly good idea for a facility like that. There are others that are well maintained, and when we're writing these rules, we don't know whether the eventual owner will be a good owner or a less than good owner. And so perhaps leaving the screening might be appropriate.
Well, I think maybe screening if it's within 100 feet of the school might not be a bad idea because of the facility.
And if it's in the R4 zone as conditional use.
But for just a general park that's...
This is saying it's just for ones that need a use permit? If it can...
No, this is on, this is period.
Does this, do these developments fall under any landscaping rules by the city?
Oh, good question.
I mean, are we just going to look at 10 boxes stacked next to one another?
I can bring that tie back. I'm fairly certain the level of investment would trigger that. Yeah. There's the perimeter, the 10% focused on the perimeter of your site stuff. I don't recall there being any carve out for RV.
That would work. Yeah. But maybe that would be part of the solution. I don't.
Having them require a little bit of landscaping to any entry signage around maybe their main office area, I don't think that's asking too much to at least have some kind of design in there.
Yeah, I don't necessarily mean that you have to block the view. I mean, you could have, a split rail fence or something around the outside to define its space or something, or make something that fits the environment or the area of town that it's in, something other than just, as I say, rows of tin cans sitting next to one another. So something distinguishing about it other than the fact that it's a bunch of trailers parked.
Yeah, small tree line, it can be decorative landscaping.
I think there can be some standards built into this so that they don't end up being eyesores. And that they have some sense of home to those people who live there.
Yeah, if I'm going to live there, I want it to look pretty. I want lots of bathrooms and I want washer dryer.
I mean, washer and dryer is a fair thing.
Now, the adjacent yard buffer would still be in place. So if you've got, say, a RV park coming in on a commercial property that is next to a residential zone, you have the adjacent yard buffer standards already in place that would require some screening. Okay. So it would be frankly redundant.
Some screening of some,
So between that, the commercial and residential zone.
Yeah.
That could be fencing or landscape screening of some kind.
Yeah, absolutely. So eliminate it, keep it.
Well, as long as there's some kind of landscaping buffer provision.
From residential, in a residential context?
Yeah, from residential for sure.
Okay.
And maybe if it were in some commercial districts as well, I don't know.
Yeah, just trying to know. Dane screening, residential. This one, this is another one for you to chat about briefly, is outside storage. The code says no, can't do it. No outside storage of materials or equipment. It's permissible except for vehicles, which, parked vehicles. That for year-round tenancy is unrealistic in my mind. it's not going to work. If you look at the non-conforming parks, you always have some degree of outside storage. For my part, I'd rather rely on the nuisance codes there. If we have a problem with somebody stacking stuff up having stuff stored outside.
The way this reads, you can't even put a barbecue out on a table.
I know, it seems too much. Agreed?
Yep.
Okay. Well, that's not nothing. There's quite a few changes in here that would reduce cost. Make it a little bit
well,
more.
Well, you know, as we go through this and perhaps bring this up to a vote, you know, at the beginning of the discussion, we had rules for a traditional manufactured home park, and then we're going to have rules for an RV park. Now the discussion seems to be, and initially the RV park was for transient folks who'd be coming in for a day or a week or two, and now we seem to be pushing the discussion towards an RV park as a permanent a place for folks to live in. And if it's going to be more of a permanent a park for folks to live in, perhaps these rules should be pushed more towards the manufactured home park side. Just a thought.
No, it's fair. I can bring what we have. We don't have much left on the manufactured dwelling parks because a lot of the standards the state preempted, but I could bring those back so you have them when you look at this next. That's kind of the direction it's gone. First, it was the manufactured dwelling parks, and then the states preempted local governments from imposing most standards to manufactured dwelling parks. Certainly, we can't impose something on manufactured dwellings we don't do for single family. That's kind of the direction.
Oh, that's how that
kind of evolved.
That wasn't my thought, Derek.
No,
my thought seemed that it never. My thought seemed to be that you were minimizing standards in an RV park that weren't minimized in a traditional manufactured home community.
Well, I can bring the manufactured home standards that we have so you can compare and contrast them next time you take a look at it. And that way you could point at what you see what those discrepancies really are.
And we can't regulate tenancy. Is that what you
Correct.
Said earlier?
Yeah, we cannot delve into tenancy. That's that's kind of a no-no.
Yeah, so permanent is what it's going to be for some people.
Well, in a lot of the, I see more and more parks allowing month-to-month rentals. They still have a certain amount of spaces that they'll put aside for that. In the mix of all their other nightly rental sites for, you know, for regular RVs.
Gary, is that kind of like the concept they have at Harbor Village?
No, Harbor Village is more, more month-to-month rentals.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the one, Harbor Village is the one that's over by the Embarcadero.
Yeah. Right.
Yes.
And that one is they have a few night-to-night rentals there by the office, but when you get back
right.
into the park, most of those are permanent sites.
Those
are all park models back there. There isn't a whole lot of RVs. So they have night-to-night rentals for sure, and they do have a mix, but most of that is monthly rental sites.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's an owner's association now that owns that whole thing. So that gives you a sense of just how vested they are in that facility. And it's a blend. You've got you got manufactured dwellings there and RVs. It's a blend across. It's a fairly large site too.
Yeah, actually it's pretty big. It goes back up on that hill quite a ways. Yeah.
But to some of the earlier discussion, for them to take ownership of that, they've also had to commit to reinvesting in upgrading all of the utilities to all of that. So they're going to be pouring millions into redoing the water and wastewater lines and whatnot. And then you just go show, I mean, those are pretty critical components if you're going to be living year round, whether or not it's in an RV or manufactured dwelling.
Well, if you're going to be going into a spot and do a month to month rental at any place you go to, I imagine that tenant is, that would be a minimum of amount of standards that they would expect to have at least functioning
right
water, power, and sewer hookup.
So the last standard here just is one I can confirm with the state as to what this language should be. It talks about a certificate of sanitation. I don't know that that's even required anymore, but I can get that clarified and we can address that. Again, this is the code that hasn't been touched in a meaningful way in decades. And so
some of this stuff is just outdated. Great, I got some good info from you on this in terms of what I need to do. Next up was the, just confirming with you that I picked up the other changes appropriately. So in the draft I sent you, I just, there were four changes. I highlighted them. First one was on page 29. Oops, of my packet. We'll see what one that is in here. What's that?
I did have one, I don't know, it's a general comment, but there's references to 30 days and there's references to 1 month. Imagine some of that comes from OAR, but sure would be nice to be consistent.
Okay.
Just month.
Which
to
code
month.
Were you looking at? Just through this whole package, Bob?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm looking on page 26, your comments.
Yeah.
Period of time that is less than 1 month.
Yeah, I think we talked about that last time, huh? The 30 days or 1 month. Or...
All right, I can take a look at that and get that done. Okay, so the first one change here was under the garage setback, within rights of way, not undeveloped rights of way, which was a change you guys had requested. Makes sense.
Wait, where are we?
This would be page 5 of 15. Or
okay.
Or 29 of the packet, whichever one you're looking at. Next change was roof pitch. That was where changed from a 512 to a 412.
Yep.
That was page 7 of 15 or 31 of the packet. That right there. Next one was had to do, Bob, with the comment you made, had to do with parallel parking. So I was able to work that in. It's page 10 of 15. So each on-street parking space, talk about its dimensions, parallel to the edge of the street, so that gives you your parallel parking, unless an alternate configuration's been approved and marked by the city. So that's, so if we do angle in a very, and we don't do that very often, but it would be in a very specific configuration that's designed for that at that point. And then the last change was on page 37.
What is this status of your notes? They don't go forward anywhere. They just stay as part of our deliberations, but the code, so in other words, if I find a typo in your notes, should I bring it up?
Yeah, let me know, I might as well.
All right, very at top of page 36, second line. Could be vehicle instead of care. I think you meant car, but.
So page would be 12 and 15. Top of, where curbs exist, wheels of parallel park. Yeah, car, not care.
I would make it vehicle because it doesn't have to be a
car. It did pass spell vehicle. Check though, so you have to give him credit for that.
Hey. just to be clear, my comments in here are for context only. They do end up in the ordinance along with the red line, but it's very clear at the top. Staff comments are, you know, are not part of the amendments, but they have been useful at times to, you know.
Yeah, go back and.
You go back and understand
why. Oh, I like them. Yeah.
Why did
yeah.
the standard yeah. get changed?
Yeah.
I saw you mention that between the 412 and the 512
mm-hmm.
in your notes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then the last change on this was page 13 of 15 or 37. And John, this was a comment you had made about making it clear that it's in the community development director. That's the community development director determines if an additional dwelling unit, you know, is generated, and therefore this should fall into our ministerial process. And
shouldn't you say that the way you just said it, and in other words, third line, director determines that it will allow additional units instead of one or more dwelling units or additional dwelling units.
Well, one or more, that's a...
Well, I know that's the same as additional, but additional is, I think, a better word there.
I think the one or more, though, is probably consistent with the state language, too, right?
Sorry, you can leave it. I don't...
Okay.
But it's... The English reads better if you just say additional.
Okay. And if they disagree, they always have the option of going through the non-ministerial process and appealing it up to you guys. We can't make a ministerial process appealable. It would not be ministerial anymore if that was the case. So,
right.
But that would be their option. So if they disagreed, felt strongly about it, they could go the other deviation route, and it would make it to you on appeal.
Now, how do you determine you when you sit down to look at a proposal?
Well, I got to look at the adjustments in context and whether or not it realistically would result in an additional dwelling unit or not. You know, it's not an ideal. It's from where I'd be looking at it is from a very practical perspective. It's not. I can make a dwelling unit bigger. You know, that's not the objective. Is can you get it? Would the application of the existing standard prohibit you from getting the additional dwelling unit? Well, that's how I'd be looking at it. So it depends on the circumstances and how many. There could be more than one adjustment under 10% that comes into play there. But I think it's frankly would be pretty straightforward.
Did they present you with two sets of plans?
Well, that or one set of plans saying here's it. Express application of the standard, this is what I could get within this footprint, you know, in this orientation on this particular property, but with this deviation, this is what I can accomplish, you know, and it results in an additional unit or two or three additional units if it's multi-story, because they get a little bit more room within which to put the building. So again, these are small adjustments. We are talking about less than 10% of a numerical standard, so or less than or equal to. So those all look good?
Yep.
Awesome. So for your regular session, if you're comfortable, it'd be great if you could do the motion to initiate the legislative process so I can float a notice out to the state, because I got to do that 35 days in advance. And so what I'll do is I'll leave these as is, but then I would attach the park piece with the modifications we talked about and get them an initial draft of that too, so it can be part of the same package.
You have that as action 4A during the regular session?
During the regular session, yeah.
Okay.
So we have just one other item on the work session that has to do with Holte. And I guess with that, I have... I don't know. Part of me wonders whether or not we're really equipped to tackle this or not at this point in time, given our staffing. But, you know, you have Portland, who's really the only jurisdiction who's doing this right now, this home, and looks like they limit it to 3% basically of the building permits they do per year. They do about 3,400 building permits a year. And, they allow 100 applications, I believe is what they do. So it's the homebuyer opportunity limited tax exemption. You know, it certainly would be a way for folks to help those that are struggling to get into home ownership get there. But it could have a significant impact on the city's taxes too if we're allowing it for everything. I mean, so... my thought is if we go down this path, we probably would want to limit it to something akin to like no more than 10 applications a year. I mean, we're somewhere between, I mean, well, over the last 10 years, we've averaged 50 units a year, but that's not single family. I mean, that number goes up because of some significant multifamily development. And over the last few years, that's 80 units, or I think over the last five, it's 8 units a year.
So what you're saying is, given the limited staffing, and it seems to me there's not that much, a 10 unit sounds good, but not much need, well, there's always a need for it, but what I mean is that when you outweigh getting number of units and the amount of money that's available, the cost for a new home, you know, and is this like a down payment assistance program or something like that?
No, it's actually, it's comparable, but it's different. It comes at the property tax side of it. So okay. It's eliminated. I mean, if you
helps me with
eliminate the property tax for a 10-year period, well, that's going to reduce their payments.
Yes.
Because they don't have to escrow what they would otherwise have to escrow to cover their property taxes. And so that drops that down for a 10-year period. It's a way to help them into the unit. And, you know, Portland looks at it at 80% median area income. I mean, we could look at it at 100% median area income. I mean.
So I was.
Portland's a huge city, and we're small, and I don't know.
I was fishing around to see if there were any follow-ups on Portland and how the program's going, and I noticed their council approved an expansion of the program.
Okay.
In the summer, because it looked like everybody who qualified for a system development charge exemption or reduction also qualified for this program. So they've actually increased the cap to 500.
Wow.
Really interesting thing in the staff report is that to date, 40% of the applicants failed to qualify. Which I'm not really all that surprised, because the numbers still don't work when you look at our median
right
sale price and the amount of money you've got to make, and our median income. You can only buy a $200,000 house, and we're at a median of $450,000-$500,000.
You'd be lucky to get 10.
Changing that dynamic by $100, given the staff work that you would have to do. So it sounds like Portland's spending a lot of staff time vetting these and kicking out 4 out of every 10.
Mm-hmm.
Do we want to go down that road? Either. I mean, we're throwing a lot of administrative burden at you.
Yeah, this is a heavy administrative lift, and I'm not sure the bang for the buck's there. That's where I'm concerned about it.
And then you got to monitor them every year, make sure that, well, I don't know about sales tax, but if you had like home funds or federal CD community development block grant to whatever to put it all.
Part of me wonders if at the end of the day, because we got to report this stuff. I have to report. Well, we'll have to report that. Hey, we looked at this issue. It strikes me that this is one where, if this is something where a local government, this may not be a best structured as a city administered program for small cities. This might be better structured as a state program.
Yeah.
That smaller jurisdictions can enroll into, because Portland can handle this, but Portland's Portland.
Yeah.
They have a massive amount of staff and resources. They have an entire housing bureau to do this kind of stuff. The value is here. I could see its application. It's just like, but can we actually reasonably do this kind of a lift? And that's where I get concerned.
Yeah,
well, the provisions
that are in there.
Yeah, we have a time frame,
Portland,
too.
Would be impossible for you to, you and your staff to monitor. I mean, just is totally impractical. And then if you don't do what you're supposed to do because of the provision, then the city has some liability there.
Well, and
that it's more trouble than it's worth at this point.
But you can always go back, right? Because there's a time frame to implement these, right? And even though this was an important.
Well, we can report kind of that we've explored it to this extent, and this is the concern why we're not moving forward with it. That doesn't mean the city couldn't move forward with some variation of the program in the future, or if the state changes the rules that in a way that's more favorable to smaller jurisdictions, and maybe the city wants to move on it at that point in time.
Yeah.
Then how about?
But I, yeah, I'm, John, I'm in the same conclusion. It's, you know, it's, I just don't.
Were you trying to say something? We're hearing from you.
No, the lady's asking me if I want breakfast, that's all.
Own up.
Yeah, we want breakfast. Own up. We want breakfast.
Okay, so
I don't think this is
for this purpose, maybe no. We just memorialize in the
yeah.
in the minutes that this discussion was had and that you know that a program
yes.
like this is just a little bit more than we can tackle at this point.
Did you, I'm just curious, did you have any discussions with county or school district to see whether they might buy in? Because one of them would have to.
Well, it probably would be the county at the end of the day, but you know, even if they bought in on the property tax side of it, they're not going to help with the administrative side of it.
Right. I mean, I was just curious. It's not.
No, I have not.
Okay.
No. Probably wouldn't do that unless we had this more fleshed out and in a position where we could actually talk to them about the specifics of the program and exactly what its impacts would be to them.
I'd rather see the city take that money and build houses with it, even if it's just one every 3 years. We need doors.
I mean, this is a lot of administration.
Now you're talking like Dustin. We need doors.
Yeah.
Well, I had to say it because Dustin wasn't here.
4 and 10. Thanks for looking that up. I didn't see that they're basically rejecting 4 and 10 applications.
Yeah, they can't qualify. They're
yeah.
Wow. I ran a program like that where I used to work when I retired 3 months ago, and it was really hard to get people to qualify. Their credit was not so good, and they couldn't find any housing that even with $100,000, this was in the case instead of property taxes, down payment assistance. So the city would carry a second loan. I don't think we used to get like $200,000 a year, and last couple of years we didn't get any. Nobody could, either if they qualified, they couldn't find a house that was $300,000. And so we had to give the money back to the county. We didn't like doing that.
No, I imagine not.
So Bill, that's all we had for the work session.
Okay.
I guess I can mention I'll just mention on the city center, we're waiting.
Yeah.
And we're continuing to wait, and we have to wait. Since more than half of the project funding is coming from the state, we're waiting for a funding agreement. It's an intergovernmental agreement, and it's been in the hopper for forever.
They have your money.
Huh?
And they have your money.
Well, they will. I mean, the IGA basically spells out this is the total project budget, this is the scope of work, and this is the city. If you sign on to this, you have to give us X amount of money, and you know, so that's how it's set up. I think one of the challenges the state, frankly, is running into is there's been a lot of federal money that's been routed through the state for distribution, and infrastructure is one area in particular, and the state hasn't geared up on the procurement side, and so they're backlogged. They're backlogged at the Department of Justice. And you saw from the email, John, they're to the point now where they're paying to have this expedited. I still haven't seen anything since my December 14th communication to them. So it's not expedited is relative with these folks. The frustration is that this will be the third time that the contractor in this case has had to build out the whole program. So they're going to have to redo the entire schedule again because we were supposed to start this in the fall, and we're still waiting for a funding agreement. But we've reached out to the folks that have already been appointed by the council, so they know. And we're not going to ask the rest to, fill out the rest of the committee until we actually have this funding agreement. So hopefully we'll get it in the coming weeks.
Well, some of the housing people. Sorry.
Okay, going once, going twice. The work session is adjourned, and now we will.
Oh.